For example, I should say to Emil, "Hitherto you have lived under my guidance, you were unable to rule yourself. But now you are approaching the age when the law, giving you the control over your property, makes you master of your person. You are about to find yourself alone in society, dependent on everything, even on your patrimony. You mean to marry, that is a praiseworthy intention, it is one of the duties of man, but before you marry you must know what sort of man you want to be, how you wish to spend your life, what steps you mean to take to secure a living for your family and for yourself, for although we should not make this our main business, it must be definitely considered. Do you wish to be dependent on men whom you despise? Do you wish to establish your fortune and determine your position by means of civil relations which will make you always dependent on the choice of others, which will compel you, if you would escape from knaves, to become a knave yourself? In the next place I would show him every possible way of using his money in trade, in the civil service, in finance. And I shall show him that in every one of these there are risks to be taken. Every one of them places him in a precarious and dependent position, and compels him to adapt his morals, his sentiments, his conduct to the example and the prejudices of others. There is yet another way of spending your time and money. You may join the army, that is to say, you may hire yourself out at very high wages to go and kill men who never did you any harm. This trade is held in great honor among men, and they cannot think too highly of those who are fit for nothing better. Moreover, this profession, far from making you independent of other resources, makes them all the more necessary, for it is a point of honor in this profession to ruin those who have adopted it. It is true they are not all ruined, it is even becoming fashionable to grow rich in this as in other professions, but if I told you how people manage to do it, I doubt whether you would desire to follow their example. Moreover, you must know that, even in this trade, it is no longer a question of courage or valor, and less with regard to the ladies. On the contrary, the more cringing, mean, and degraded you are, the more honor you obtain. If you have decided to take your profession seriously, you will be despised. You will be hated. You will very possibly be driven out of the service, or at least you will fall a victim to favoritism and be supplanted by your comrades, because you have been doing your duty in the trenches, while they have been attending to their toilet. We can hardly suppose that any of these occupations will be much to Emil's taste. Why, he will exclaim, have I forgotten the amusements of my childhood? Have I lost the use of my arms? Is my strength failing me? Do I not know how to work? What do I care about all your fine professions and all the silly prejudices of others? I know no other pride than to be kindly and just, no other happiness than to live in independence with her I love, gaining health and a good appetite by the day's work. All these difficulties you speak of do not concern me. The only property I desire is a little farm in some quiet corner. I will devote all my efforts after wealth to making it pay, and I will live without a care. Give me Sophie and my land, and I shall be rich. Yes, my dear friend, that is all a wise man requires, a wife and land of his own, but these treasures are scarcer than you think. The rarest you have found already, let us discuss the other. A field of your own, dear Emil. Where will you find it, in what remote corner of the earth can you say, here am I master of myself and of this estate which belongs to me? We know where a man may grow rich. Who knows where he can do without riches? Who knows where to live free and independent, without ill-treating others and without fear of being ill-treated himself? Do you think it is so easy to find a place where you can always live like an honest man? If there is any safe and lawful way of living without intrigues, without lawsuits, without dependence on others, it is, I admit, to live by the labor of our hands, by the cultivation of our own land. But where is the state in which a man can say, the earth which I dig is my own? Before choosing this happy spot, be sure that you will find the peace you desire. Beware lest an unjust government, a persecuting religion, and evil habits should disturb you in your home. Secure yourself against the excessive taxes which devour the fruits of your labors, and the endless lawsuits which consume your capital. Take care that you can live rightly without having to pay court to intendants, to their deputies, to judges, to priests, to powerful neighbors, and to knaves of every kind, who are always ready to annoy you if you neglect them. Above all, secure yourself from annoyance on the part of the rich and great. Remember that their estates may anywhere adjoin your Naboth's vineyard. If unluckily for you some great man buys or builds a house near your cottage, make sure that he will not find a way, under some pretense or other, to encroach on your lands to round off his estate, or that you do not find him at once absorbing all your resources to make a wide highroad. If you keep sufficient credit to ward off all these disagreeables, you might as well keep your money, for it will cost you no more to keep it. Riches and credit lean upon each other, the one can hardly stand without the other. I have more experience than you, dear Emile, I see more clearly the difficulties in the way of your scheme. Yet it is a fine scheme and honorable, it would make you happy indeed. Let us try to carry it out. I have a suggestion to make, let us devote the 2 years from now till the time of your return to choosing a place in Europe where you could live happily with your family, secure from all the dangers I have just described. If we succeed, you will have discovered that true happiness, so often sought for in vain, and you will not have to regret the time spent in its search. If we fail, you will be cured of a mistaken idea, you will console yourself for an inevitable ill, and you will bow to the law of necessity. I do not know whether all my readers will see whither this suggested inquiry will lead us, but this I do know, if Emile returns from his travels, begun and continued with this end in view, without a full knowledge of questions of government, public morality, and political philosophy of every kind, we are greatly lacking, he in intelligence and I in judgment. The science of politics is and probably always will be unknown. Grotius, our leader in this branch of learning, is only a child, and what is worse, an untruthful child. When I hear Grotius praised to the skies and Hobbes overwhelmed with abuse, I perceive how little sensible men have read or understood these authors. As a matter of fact, their principles are exactly alike, they only differ in their mode of expression. Their methods are also different. Hobbes relies on sophism, Grotius relies on the poets, they are agreed in everything else. In modern times, the only man who could have created this vast and useless science was the illustrious Montesquieu. But he was not concerned with the principles of political law, he was content to deal with the positive laws of settled governments, and nothing could be more different than these two branches of study. Yet he who would judge wisely in matters of actual government is forced to combine the two. He must know what ought to be in order to judge what is. The chief difficulty in the way of throwing light upon this important matter is to induce an individual to discuss and to answer these two questions. How does it concern me, and what can I do? Emile is in a position to answer both. The next difficulty is due to the prejudices of childhood, the principles in which we were brought up. It is due above all to the partiality of authors, who are always talking about truth, though they care very little about it. It is only their own interests that they care for, and of these they say nothing. Now the nation has neither professorships, nor pensions, nor membership of the academies to bestow. How then shall its rights be established by men of that type? The education I have given him has removed this difficulty also from Emile's path. He scarcely knows what is meant by government, his business is to find the best, he does not want to write books, if ever he did so, it would not be to pay court to those in authority, but to establish the rights of humanity. There is a third difficulty, more specious than real, a difficulty which I neither desire to solve nor even to state, enough that I am not afraid of it, sure I am that in inquiries of this kind, great talents are less necessary than a genuine love of justice and a sincere reverence for truth. If matters of government can ever be fairly discussed, now or never is our chance. Before beginning our observations, we must lay down rules of procedure, we must find a scale with which to compare our measurements. Our principles of political law are our scale. Our actual measurements are the civil law of each country. Our elementary notions are plain and simple, being taken directly from the nature of things. They will take the form of problems discussed between us, and they will not be formulated into principles until we have found a satisfactory solution of our problems. For example, we shall begin with the state of nature, we shall see whether men are born slaves or free, in a community or independent. Is their association the result of free will or of force? Can the force which compels them to united action ever form a permanent law, by which this original force becomes binding, even when another has been imposed upon it, so that since the power of King Nimrod, who is said to have been the first conqueror, Every other power which has overthrown the original power is unjust and usurping, so that there are no lawful kings but the descendants of Nimrod or their representatives. Or if this original power has ceased, has the power which succeeded it any right over us? And does it destroy the binding force of the former power, so that we are not bound to obey except under compulsion? And we are free to rebel as soon as we are capable of resistance. Such a right is not very different from might. It is little more than a play upon words. We shall inquire whether man might not say that all sickness comes from God, and that it is therefore a crime to send for the doctor. Again, we shall inquire whether we are bound by our conscience to give our purse to a highwayman when we might conceal it from him, for the pistol in his hand is also a power. Does this word power in this context mean something different from a power which is lawful and therefore subject to the laws to which it owes its being? Suppose we reject this theory that might is right and admit the right of nature, or the authority of the Father, as the foundation of society. We shall inquire into the extent of this authority. What is its foundation in nature? Has it any other grounds but that of its usefulness to the child, his weakness, and the natural love which his father feels towards him? When the child is no longer feeble, when he is grown up in mind as well as in body, does not he become the sole judge of what is necessary for his preservation? Is he not therefore his own master, independent of all men, even of his father himself? For is it not still more certain that the son loves himself, than that the father loves the son? The father being dead, should the children obey the eldest brother, or some other person who has not the natural affection of a father? Should there always be, from family to family, one single head to whom all the family owe obedience? If so, how has power ever come to be divided? And how is it that there is more than one head to govern the human race throughout the world? Suppose the nations to have been formed each by its own choice. We shall then distinguish between right and fact. Being thus subjected to their brothers, uncles, or other relations, not because they were obliged, but because they choose, we shall inquire whether this kind of society is not a sort of free and voluntary association. Taking next the law of slavery, we shall inquire whether a man can make over to another his right to himself, without restriction, without reserve, without any kind of conditions. That is to say, can he renounce his person, his life, his reason, his very self? Can he renounce all morality in his actions? In a word, can he cease to exist before his death, in spite of nature who places him directly in charge of his own preservation, in spite of reason and conscience which tell him what to do and what to leave undone? If there is any reservation or restriction in the deed of slavery, we shall discuss whether this deed does not then become a true contract, in which both the contracting powers, having in this respect no common master, remain their own judge as to the conditions of the contract, and therefore free to this extent, and able to break the contract as soon as it becomes hurtful. If then a slave cannot convey himself altogether to his master, how can a nation convey itself altogether to its head? If a slave is to judge whether his master is fulfilling his contract, is not the nation to judge whether its head is fulfilling his contract? Thus we are compelled to retrace our steps. And when we consider the meaning of this collective nation, we shall inquire whether some contract, a tacit contract at the least, is not required to make a nation, a contract anterior to that which we are assuming. Since the nation was a nation before it chose a king, what made it a nation, except the social contract? Therefore the social contract is the foundation of all civil society, and it is in the nature of this contract that we must seek the nature of the society formed by it. We will inquire into the meaning of this contract. May it not be fairly well expressed in this formula? As an individual, every one of us contributes his goods, his person, his life, to the common stock, under the supreme direction of the general will, while as a body we receive each member as an indivisible part of the whole. Assuming this, in order to define the terms we require, we shall observe that, instead of the individual person of each contracting party, this deed of association produces a moral and collective body, consisting of as many members as there are votes in the assembly. This public personality is usually called the body politic, which is called by its members the state when it is passive, and the sovereign when it is active, and a power when compared with its equals. With regard to the members themselves, collectively they are known as the nation, and individually as citizens as members of the city or partakers in the sovereign power, and subjects as obedient to the same authority. We shall note that this contract of association includes a mutual pledge on the part of the public and the individual, and that each individual, entering, so to speak, into a contract with himself, finds himself in a twofold capacity, i.e., as a member of the sovereign with regard to others, as member of the state with regard to the sovereign. We shall also note that while no one is bound by any engagement to which he was not himself a party, the general deliberation which may be binding on all the subjects with regard to the sovereign, because of the two different relations under which each of them is envisaged, cannot be binding on the state with regard to itself. Hence we see that there is not, and cannot be, any other fundamental law, properly so called, except the social contract only. This does not mean that the body politic cannot, in certain respects, pledge itself to others, for in regard to the foreigner, it then becomes a simple creature, an individual. Thus the two contracting parties, i.e., each individual and the public, have no common superior to decide their differences, so we will inquire if each of them remains free to break the contract at will, that is to repudiate it on his side as soon as he considers it hurtful. To clear up this difficulty, we shall observe that, according to the social pact, the sovereign power is only able to act through the common, general will, so its decrees can only have a general or common aim. Hence it follows that a private individual cannot be directly injured by the sovereign, unless all are injured, which is impossible, for that would be to want to harm oneself. Thus the social contract has no need of any warrant but the general power, for it can only be broken by individuals, and they are not therefore freed from their engagement, but punished for having broken it. To decide all such questions rightly, we must always bear in mind that the nature of the social pact is private and peculiar to itself, in that the nation only contracts with itself, i.e., the people as a whole as sovereign, with the individuals as subjects. This condition is essential to the construction and working of the political machine. It alone makes pledges lawful, reasonable, and secure, without which it would be absurd, tyrannical, and liable to the grossest abuse. Individuals having only submitted themselves to the sovereign, and the sovereign power being only the general will, we shall see that every man in obeying the sovereign only obeys himself, and how much freer are we under the social part than in the state of nature. Having compared natural and civil liberty with regard to persons, we will compare them as to property, the rights of ownership and the rights of sovereignty, the private and the common domain. If the sovereign power rests upon the right of ownership, there is no right more worthy of respect. It is inviolable and sacred for the sovereign power, so long as it remains a private individual right. As soon as it is viewed as common to all the citizens, it is subject to the common will, and this will may destroy it. Thus the sovereign has no right to touch the property of one or many, but he may lawfully take possession of the property of all, as was done in Sparta in the time of Lycurgus, while the abolition of debts by Solon was an unlawful deed. Since nothing is binding on the subjects except the general will, let us inquire how this will is made manifest, by what signs we may recognize it with certainty, what is a law, and what are the true characters of the law. This is quite a fresh subject. We have still to define the term law. As soon as the nation considers one or more of its members, the nation is divided. A relation is established between the whole and its part which makes of them two separate entities, of which the part is one, and the whole, minus that part, is the other. But the whole minus the part is not the whole. As long as this relation exists, there is no longer a whole, but two unequal parts. On the other hand, if the whole nation makes a law for the whole nation, it is only considering itself, and if a relation is set up, it is between the whole community regarded from one point of view, and the whole community regarded from another point of view, without any division of that whole. Then the object of the statute is general, and the will which makes that statute is general too. Let us see if there is any other kind of decree which may bear the name of law. If the sovereign can only speak through laws, and if the law can never have any but a general purpose, concerning all the members of the state, it follows that the sovereign never has the power to make any law with regard to particular cases, and yet it is necessary for the preservation of the state that particular cases should also be dealt with. Let us see how this can be done. The decrees of the sovereign can only be decrees of the general will, that is laws. There must also be determining decrees, decrees of power or government, for the execution of those laws, and these, on the other hand, can only have particular aims. Thus the decrees by which the sovereign decides that a chief shall be elected is a law, the decree by which that chief is elected, in pursuance of the law, is only a decree of government. This is a third relation in which the assembled people may be considered, i.e., as magistrates or executors of the law which it has passed in its capacity as sovereign. We will now inquire whether it is possible for the nation to deprive itself of its right of sovereignty, to bestow it on one or more persons, for the decree of election not being a law, and the people in this decree not being themselves sovereign, we do not see how they can transfer a right which they do not possess. The essence of sovereignty consisting in the general will, it is equally hard to see how we can be certain that an individual will shall always be in agreement with the general will. We should rather assume that it will often be opposed to it, for individual interest always tends to privileges, while the common interest always tends to equality, and if such an agreement were possible, no sovereign right could exist, unless the agreement were either necessary or indestructible. We will inquire if, without violating the social pact, the heads of the nation, under whatever name they are chosen, can ever be more than the officers of the people, entrusted by them with the duty of carrying the law into execution. Are not these chiefs themselves accountable for their administration, and are not they themselves subject to the laws which it is their business to see carried out? If the nation cannot alienate its supreme right, can it entrust it to others for a time? Cannot it give itself a master, cannot it find representatives? This is an important question and deserves discussion. If the nation can have neither sovereign nor representatives, we will inquire how it can pass its own laws. Must there be many laws? Must they be often altered? Is it easy for a great nation to be its own lawgiver? Was not the Roman people a great nation? Is it a good thing that there should be great nations? It follows from considerations already established that there is an intermediate body in the state between subjects and sovereign. And this intermediate body, consisting of one or more members, is entrusted with the public administration, the carrying out of the laws, and the maintenance of civil and political liberty. The members of this body are called magistrates or kings, that is to say, rulers. This body, as a whole, considered in relation to its members, is called the prince, and considered in its actions it is called the government. If we consider the action of the whole body upon itself, that is to say, the relation of the whole to the whole, of the sovereign to the state, we can compare this relation to that of the extremes in a proportion of which the government is the middle term. The magistrate receives from the sovereign the commands which he gives to the nation, and when it is reckoned up, his product or his power is in the same degree as the product or power of the citizens who are subjects on one side of the proportion and sovereigns on the other. None of the three terms can be varied without at once destroying this proportion. If the sovereign tries to govern, and if the prince wants to make the laws, or if the subject refuses to obey them, disorder takes the place of order, and the state falls to pieces under despotism or anarchy. Let us suppose that this state consists of 10,000 citizens. The sovereign can only be considered collectively and as a body, but each individual, as a subject, has his private and independent existence. Thus the sovereign is as 10,000 to 1, that is to say, every member of the state has, as his own share, only 1/10,000th part of the sovereign power, although he is subject to the whole. Let the nation be composed of 100,000 men, the position of the subjects is unchanged, and each continues to bear the whole weight of the laws, while his vote, reduced to the 100,000th part, has 10 times less influence in the making of the laws. Thus the subject being always one, the sovereign is relatively greater as the number of the citizens is increased. Hence it follows that the larger the state, the less liberty. Now the greater the disproportion between private wishes and the general will, i.e., between manners and laws, the greater must be the power of repression. On the other side, the greatness of the state gives the depositaries of public authority greater temptations and additional means of abusing that authority, so that the more power is required by the government to control the people, the more power should there be in the sovereign to control the government. From this twofold relation it follows that the continued proportion between the sovereign, the prince, and the people is not an arbitrary idea, but a consequence of the nature of the state. Moreover, it follows that one of the extremes, i.e., the nation, being constant, every time the double ratio increases or decreases, the simple ratio increases or diminishes in its turn, which cannot be unless the middle term is as often changed. From this we may conclude that there is no single absolute form of government, but there must be as many different forms of government as there are states of different size. If the greater the numbers of the nation, the less the ratio between its manners and its laws, by a fairly clear analogy, we may also say, the more numerous the magistrates, the weaker the government. To make this principle clearer, we will distinguish three essentially different wills in the person of each magistrate. First, his own will as an individual, which looks to his own advantage only. Secondly, the common will of the magistrates, which is concerned only with the advantage of the prince, a will which may be called corporate. And one which is general in relation to the government and particular in relation to the state of which the government forms part. Thirdly, the will of the people, or the sovereign will, which is general, as much in relation to the state viewed as the whole as in relation to the government viewed as a part of the whole. In a perfect legislature, the private individual will should be almost nothing, the corporate will belonging to the government should be quite subordinate, and therefore the general and sovereign will is the master of all the others. On the other hand, in the natural order, these different wills become more and more active in proportion as they become centralized, the general will is always weak, the corporate will takes the second place, the individual will is preferred to all, so that every one is himself first, then a magistrate, and then a citizen. A series just the opposite of that required by the social order. Having laid down this principle, let us assume that the government is in the hands of one man. In this case, the individual and the corporate will are absolutely one, and therefore this will has reached the greatest possible degree of intensity. Now the use of power depends on the degree of this intensity, and as the absolute power of the government is always that of the people, and therefore invariable, it follows that the rule of one man is the most active form of government. If, on the other hand, we unite the government with the supreme power, and make the prince the sovereign and the citizen so many magistrates, then the corporate will is completely lost in the general will, and will have no more activity than the general will, and it will leave the individual will in full vigor. Thus the government, though its absolute force is constant, will have the minimum of activity. These rules are incontestable in themselves, and other considerations only serve to confirm them. For example, we see the magistrates as a body far more active than the citizens as a body, so that the individual will always counts for more. For each magistrate usually has charge of some particular duty of government, while each citizen, in himself, has no particular duty of sovereignty. Moreover, the greater the state, the greater its real power, although its power does not increase because of the increase in territory. But the state remaining unchanged, the magistrates are multiplied in vain, the government acquires no further real strength, because it is the depositary of that of the state, which I have assumed to be constant. Thus, this plurality of magistrates decreases the activity of the government without increasing its power. Having found that the power of the government is relaxed in proportion as the number of magistrates is multiplied, and that the more numerous the people, the more the controlling power must be increased, we shall infer that the ratio between the magistrates and the government should be inverse to that between subjects and sovereign, that is to say, that the greater the state, the smaller the government. And that in like manner the number of chiefs should be diminished because of the increased numbers of the people. In order to make this diversity of forms clearer, and to assign them their different names, we shall observe in the first place that the sovereign may entrust the care of the government to the whole nation or to the greater part of the nation, so that there are more citizen magistrates than private citizens. This form of government is called democracy. Or the sovereign may restrict the government in the hands of a lesser number, so that there are more plain citizens than magistrates, and this form of government is called aristocracy. Finally, the sovereign may concentrate the whole government in the hands of one man. This is the third and commonest form of government, and is called monarchy or royal government. We shall observe that all these forms, or the first and second at least, may be less or more, and that within tolerably wide limits. For the democracy may include the whole nation, or may be confined to one half of it. The aristocracy, in its turn, may shrink from the half of the nation to the smallest number. Even royalty may be shared, either between father and son, between two brothers, or in some other fashion. There were always two kings in Sparta, and in the Roman Empire there were as many as eight emperors at once, and yet it cannot be said that the empire was divided. There is a point where each form of government blends with the next, and under the three specific forms there may be really as many forms of government as there are citizens in the state. Nor is this all. In certain respects, each of these governments is capable of subdivision into different parts, each administered in one of these three ways. From these forms in combination there may arise a multitude of mixed forms, since each may be multiplied by all the simple forms. In all ages there have been great disputes as to which is the best form of government, and people have failed to consider that each is the best in some cases and the worst in others. For ourselves, if the number of magistrates in the various states is to be an inverse ratio to the number of the citizens, we infer that generally a democratic government is adapted to small states, an aristocratic government to those of moderate size, and a monarchy to large states. These inquiries furnish us with a clue by which we may discover what are the duties and rights of citizens, and whether they can be separated one from the other. What is our country, in what does it really consist? And how can each of us ascertain whether he has a country or no? Having thus considered every kind of civil society in itself, we shall compare them, so as to note their relations one with another. Great and small, strong and weak, attacking one another, insulting one another, destroying one another. And in this perpetual action and reaction causing more misery and loss of life than if men had preserved their original freedom. We shall inquire whether too much or too little has not been accomplished in the matter of social institutions, whether individuals who are subject to law and to men, while societies preserve the independence of nature, are not exposed to the ills of both conditions without the advantages of either, and whether it would not be better to have no civil society in the world rather than to have many such societies. Is it not that mixed condition which partakes of both and secures neither? Per quem neutrum licet, any si tanquam in bello paratum esse, any si tanquam in pace securum. Seneca de Trang, Animi, Cap. I, is it not this partial and imperfect association which gives rise to tyranny and war? And are not tyranny and war the worst scourges of humanity? Finally, we will inquire how men seek to get rid of these difficulties by means of leagues and confederations, which leave each state its own master in internal affairs, while they arm it against any unjust aggression. We will inquire how a good federal association may be established, what can make it lasting, and how far the rights of the federation may be stretched without destroying the right of sovereignty. The Abbé de Saint-Pierre suggested an association of all the states of Europe to maintain perpetual peace among themselves. Is this association practicable, and supposing that it were established, would it be likely to last? These inquiries lead us straight to all the questions of international law which may clear up the remaining difficulties of political law. Finally, we shall lay down the real principles of the laws of war, and we shall see why Grotius and others have only stated false principles. I should not be surprised if my pupil, who is a sensible young man, should interrupt me saying, "One would think we were building our edifice of wood and not of men, we are putting everything southwest exactly in its place." That is true, but remember that the law does not bow to the passions of men, and that we have first to establish the true principles of political law. Now that our foundations are laid, come and see what men have built upon them, and you will see some strange sights. Then I set him to read Telemachus, and we pursue our journey. We are seeking that happy Salentum and the good Idomeneus made wise by misfortunes. By the way, we find many like Proxylus and no Philocles, neither can Adrastes, king of the Daunians, be found. But let our readers picture our travels for themselves, or take the same journeys with Telemachus in their hand, and let us not suggest to them painful applications which the author himself avoids or makes in spite of himself. Moreover, Emile is not a king, nor am I a god, so that we are not distressed that we cannot imitate Telemachus and Mentor in the good they did. None know better than we how to keep to our own place, none have less desire to leave it. We know that the same task is allotted to all, that whoever loves what is right with all his heart, and does the right so far as it is in his power, has fulfilled the task. We know that Telemachus and Mentor are creatures of the imagination. Emile does not travel in idleness, and he does more good than if he were a prince. If we were kings, we should be no greater benefactors. If we were kings and benefactors, we should cause any number of real evils for every apparent good we supposed we were doing. If we were kings and sages, the first good deed we should desire to perform, for ourselves and for others, would be to abdicate our kingship and return to our present position. I have said why travel does so little for every one. What makes it still more barren for the young is the way in which they are sent on their travels. Tutors, more concerned to amuse than to instruct, take them from town to town, from palace to palace, where if they are men of learning and letters, they make them spend their time in libraries, or visiting antiquaries, or rummaging among old buildings transcribing ancient inscriptions. In every country they are busy over some other century, as if they were living in another country, so that after they have traveled all over Europe at great expense, a prey to frivolity or tedium, they return, having seen nothing to interest them, and having learnt nothing that could be of any possible use to them. All capitals are just alike, they are a mixture of all nations and all ways of living, they are not the place in which to study the nations. Paris and London seem to me the same town. Their inhabitants have a few prejudices of their own, but each has as many as the other, and all their rules of conduct are the same. We know the kind of people who will throng the court. We know the way of living which the crowds of people and the unequal distribution of wealth will produce. As soon as anyone tells me of a town with 200,000 people, I know its life already. What I do not know about it is not worth going there to learn. To study the genius and character of a nation you should go to the more remote provinces, where there is less stir, less commerce, where strangers seldom travel, where the inhabitants stay in one place, where there are fewer changes of wealth and position. Take a look at the capital on your way, but go and study the country far away from that capital. The French are not in Paris, but in Turin, the English are more English in Murcia than in London, and the Spaniards more Spanish in Galicia than in Madrid. In these remoter provinces a nation assumes its true character and shows what it really is, there the good or ill effects of the government are best perceived, just as you can measure the arc more exactly at a greater radius. The necessary relations between character and government have been so clearly pointed out in the book of L'Esprit de Lois, that one cannot do better than have recourse to that work for the study of those relations. But speaking generally, there are two plain and simple standards by which to decide whether governments are good or bad. One is the population. Every country in which the population is decreasing is on its way to ruin, and the countries in which the population increases most rapidly, even were they the poorest countries in the world, are certainly the best governed. But this population must be the natural result of the government and the national character, for if it is caused by colonization or any other temporary and accidental cause, then the remedy itself is evidence of the disease. When Augustus passed laws against celibacy, those laws showed that the Roman Empire was already beginning to decline. Citizens must be induced to marry by the goodness of the government, not compelled to marry by law. You must not examine the effects of force, for the law which strives against the Constitution has little or no effect. You should study what is done by the influence of public morals and by the natural inclination of the government, for these alone produce a lasting effect. It was the policy of the worthy Abbé de Saint-Pierre always to look for a little remedy for every individual ill, instead of tracing them to their common source and seeing if they could not all be cured together. You do not need to treat separately every sore on a rich man's body. You should purify the blood which produces them. They say that in England there are prizes for agriculture, that is enough for me, that is proof enough that agriculture will not flourish there much longer. The second sign of the goodness or badness of the government and the laws is also to be found in the population, but it is to be found not in its numbers but in its distribution. Two states equal in size and population may be very unequal in strength, and the more powerful is always that in which the people are more evenly distributed over its territory. The country which has fewer large towns, and makes less show on this account, will always defeat the other. It is the great towns which exhaust the state and are the cause of its weakness. The wealth which they produce is a sham wealth, there is much money and few goods. They say the town of Paris is worth a whole province to the King of France, for my own part one believe it costs him more than several provinces. I believe that Paris is fed by the provinces in more senses than one, and that the greater part of their revenues is poured into that town and stays there, without ever returning to the people or to the king. It is inconceivable that in this age of calculators there is no one to see that France would be much more powerful if Paris were destroyed. Not only is this ill-distributed population not advantageous to the state, it is more ruinous than depopulation itself, because depopulation only gives as produce not, and the ill-regulated addition of still more people gives a negative result. When I hear an Englishman and a Frenchman so proud of the size of their capitals, and disputing whether London or Paris has more inhabitants, it seems to me that they are quarreling as to which nation can claim the honor of being the worst governed. Study the nation outside its towns, thus only will you really get to know it.